Before we started the final topic, is I wanted to finish up where we left off last week. Just to quickly review, we're ending the topic of the definition of the timing of death. What is it that constitutes death, al pi halacha? So one of the rayot that people who support brain death bring in, that Rav Moshe also supported brain death to the point of allowing in its fullest scope cardiac transplants, was the known fact that he had allowed certain people to accept cardiac transplants. And we discussed that that certainly does not prove anything in terms of okaying donation or okaying taking a heart out of somebody on the basis of brain death, because it's quite possible to be machalik between accepting a heart and donating and we're taking from a donor and heart. And we further mentioned that Rav Eliyashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman, who are the ones that emphasize this chiluk, further added the additional chiddush that the heter to accept a heart is only true in Chutz Haaretz, but not in Eretz Yisrael. So we started to analyze exactly why that might be. And we focused really on two issues. We focused on one, in terms of what actually happens in the process of procuring a heart, is there anything that the person who puts himself on the list, the makabel of the heart, is doing that could be called a gorim ritzicha, or something that is aser in the gedder of the iser ritzicha enough that it's yarva yavor, and he wouldn't be allowed to do that. He would have to be willing to die rather than to do that. And we saw that the most that people were able to come up with when you analyze the process is that either the person who puts himself on the list is a gor mitzicha, because by not refusing the heart at the point when they've decided that he's a good match and they're able to give him this heart, he is in effect shortening the life of the donor of that heart. Because had he refused at that point to take the heart, by necessity, they would have to begin this process all over, find another recipient, go through the whole checking process, and however long that would take, he, by accepting the heart, shortens, by that amount, the life of the donor. Otherwise, the only other room that we saw for an issue here would be lifnei iver. We then got to the point where, in analyzing the difference of opinion between Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Rav Shlomo Zalman as to why it would be considered begeder ritzicha, we honed in on one sugya. We honed in on the sugya with Ula in the Darim, where we see a case where Ula felt that his life was threatened. He was in a case of pikuach nefesh, and therefore, at least in words, he facilitated the final murder of somebody who was likely to be dying anyway. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik saw this as a consistency with stating that a person who puts himself on the transplant list is also the matzav shel pikuach nefesh, involving somebody who, even if you don't accept brain death, will be dying certainly under all conditions. And therefore, in that setting, even though he's an accessory, he's involved in the ritzicha of the person who's donating the heart, by no means is he a gorim. By no means, the same way that Ula was not a gorim, and therefore Ula was allowed to do this, so too is the person who puts himself on the list. But we ended off by with that somewhat difficult to understand chiluk that the Rambam made famous and Rav Shlomo Zalman applies over here, that we cannot necessarily learn from what happened with Ula and apply it to the case of a chola who is the sakana because of his machala and wants to then be an accessory to the killing of the donor. What's the difference? So it's a simple difference of beratzon or beomis. And we discussed it a little, and I discussed it further with other people. And just based on conversations I had with some of you and with Rav Bednarsh and others, I think that I would capture the difference as follows. What I felt most comfortable with in understanding the difference between the case of a chola who is compelled because of his illness to then be over on something that's normally Yavar Yavor, and we consider him guilty, and we consider him to be doing something that he, if he's over on one of the Averos, he should be Chayav Misa for. Whereas a person who has a gun held to his head, or in the case of Ula, where he's threatened immediately with retaliation by the murderer, is the idea that something could be considered beratzon if the only reason you're doing it is because of your ratzon. Meaning that if we just take the Rambam's chiluk alone, the Rambam would say that a person who is over the avodah zarah because somebody is holding a gun to his head, why ultimately is the avodah zarah taking place? Because the person holding the gun wants it to. That's whose ratzon is really being carried out here. I, the onus, am going to do it. I certainly have the chiyur, there's no denying that, but there's a gun to my head. The reason ultimately that I am being over the avodah zarah is because he wants me to be. In no way do I want to do that. I have no desire from anywhere inside of me to be doing the avodah zarah. As opposed to the person who has a machla, someone who's a chola, and it's coming from within them, ultimately it is their ratzon that the, if it's a case of the avodah zarah as the refuah, that avodah zarah take place. Right? Everyone, just you should know, if you're not happy with that explanation, which is certainly understandable, there are certainly achronim that disagree with this whole chiluk and don't see the difference at all. They say that both cases of onus, why should there be any difference? Neither one wants to be in the position where they're being over on that avera, and that the chiluk I just made is quite artificial. Nevertheless, If I'm still interested in any other suggestions on understanding it, that was a summary of my multiple conversations with many people on this issue. Okay. At the end of the day, though, we still have to explain that second chiddush of Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Yashar, and that is that there's a difference between what goes on in accepting a heart in the United States, let's say, in Chutz La'aretz, versus doing it here. According to Ramon Soloveitchik, it should not make a difference. Once you say that a person in this position is not at all a Gar Mitzvicha, right? If you put yourself on a list, you're so indirectly involved, right? And you have the Heter of Ula, which he's going to apply, that you have nothing to worry about. It should not make a difference whether the donor of the heart is a Jew or a non-Jew. And I would assume that Ramon Soloveitchik would say the same thing in Eretz Yisrael, and he would say in Chutz La'aretz, that you can be listed just as the same here, although I didn't hear it before from him, but it definitely follows from the way he explains the sugya. Shlomo Zalman, on the other hand, said no. Now, it is certainly, lefi ani hastati, not as simple as to say that the ritzicha of a non bnei bris is only an issur derabanan, right? And that's why there's a difference. Why can't it be that simple? Because if it was that, so that's pasha, right? Oh, we're going to be worried about an issur derabanan in the face of people of nefesh. It's far more complex than that. And if you turn to page 7 of the handout, page 7.
Page 6. Today's handout?
No. Last week's handout. There you go. Okay, I happen to have an extra. Here's where the Shlomo Zalman details. Now, it's going to be very fascinating to watch the back and forth here. Rav Shlomo Zalman himself goes through as he writes this response. This is a response to Rav Feivel Cohen, who had written the Shaila about what to do in the United States, right? Is it okay to allow people in the United States to accept heart transplants? So in responding, Rav Shlomo Zalman goes through the following different thought processes. So we have to go through this together on page 7. First of all, the starting point is fascinating because this is a point that Rav Tandler will emphasize following the writing of this letter, and that is Rav Shlomo Zalman is willing to accept, in the same vein that he understood Rav Moshe, accepting brain death. Meaning that if the imaging study is done, that will show, and he says that you have to do it twice, which it's hard enough, in my experience, to assume anyone's doing this once, let alone twice. And we'll talk about that in a minute, in terms of the practical reality of what Rav Shlomo Zalman is about to say.
But he says that assuming they do this imaging study to show no blood circulation to the brain, and they do it twice, he's willing to grant that that is kahuta as rosho, o kenishpera mefrakto shel zaken, the chashid kemes, gam b'li rov basar. And he says that even if, right, there are going to be those that doubt this, he says, al kolpanim safik akarav levadai mihu hada. Right? So I'm on the second paragraph of the letter on page 7. So point number one is, he's willing to give some credence to brain death under the following conditions. It's obviously not absolute, because again, he will maintain it doesn't work in Eretz Yisrael at all. But in the United States, he's going to throw it in, along with all these other nekudas, he's going to make this nice tziruf leheter, right? He's going to say, point number one is that there is some validity to brain death, according to the way Rabbi Tendler and Rav Moshe are presenting. Number two, while there were some that argued we can't assume that donors are rov nochrim, he's willing to accept that. Right? This is a discussion we didn't get into. It's a very technical discussion, which I'm not going to get into right now. Anyone wants to talk about it, it's actually interesting on this. But Rav Shlomo Zalman says that for sure, Mikar Adin, he feels that if you're dealing with a case as in Hutzlaritz, you can assume that rove donors are nochrim. Why does that impact on things? We'll see in a minute. So, again, point number one is he's giving some credence to brain death. Number two, rove are not Jewish. And number three, he says at the bottom of this paragraph, the person's going to die anyway, and that is relevant. That the donor, Mistama, is going to, even if you don't take the heart, it's either going to go to someone else, or they're going to just take him off the respirator, and he's finished either way. Coupling together all three of those facts in the face of what? In the face of Pikuach Nefesh for a Jew, right? Then he sees that it's mutter. So that's the first statement of Rishon Zalman. It's based on those three nekudos, coupled together against Pikuach Nefesh, you can do it. Then he suddenly says, in the next paragraph, he says, but in Eretz Yisrael, there's a big problem. And it starts with the donor. If the donor is a Jew, so what are we going to have to do to the donor in order to allow his heart to be taken? What's the first step, according to what he just said? The imaging study, right? We're going to have to take this donor in order to prove that they're brain dead. We're going to have to inject into them dye to show, right, dye or a radionuclide material that will show that there's no blood circulation to the brain. So he said, that is usher to do in a gosis. Right? If it's a Jew, right, he says, how can we do that? This Jew is not dead yet, right? He's suffic, he's a gosis, suffic mace. And therefore, if you start fooling around and doing things to him, you're going to be involved possibly in putting an end to his life. Therefore, he says, you cannot do it in Eretz Yisrael. You can't even get off the ground because you can't really do this test. And even though, he says, Rabbi Tendler will insist that this test requires no intervention. You're not moving the person. You're just injecting a little dye. He was told by his doctors, Rav Shlomo Zalman, who I would tend to agree with, by the way, on this fact, that there's probably more intervention and there's more damage you can do to a gosis injecting some type of dye into them than in any of the other minor activities that we'll see are also to do to a gosis. So he says, for that reason, we can't do it in Eretz Yisrael. What's the obvious question?
Can't do it on a Jew and Chassart either.
Or how about a
guy?
Right? Because who's going to be doing it to the non-Jew? The doctor, Rove Toms, is going to be also a non-Jew. So even if you're going to come up with some type of, which you're not getting into now, some type of understanding that for a Bnei Bris to be involved in the Tzicha of a non-Bnei Bris is a category unto itself. Certainly, the Chuli Alma, it is Asami Daraisa and Tzicha for a non-Bnei Bris to be a Roteach of a non-Bnei Bris. So therefore, if he really considers the problem in Eretz Yisrael to be getting involved with the Goseis and doing this type of intervention, doing it to a Jew, then he has the same problem with Chutzaretz. And in fact, he switches gears, and in the next paragraph, it's exactly what he says. He says, "Ach," we're on the top of the left side, second paragraph. "Ach shuv hitbonanti demaoso atam," what we just described. "Yesh la'asur l'chora gam b'chutzlaretz sheharei af Hagoy asur lo laharog goy. Umistaber shigam asur lekarib mitas agoses. Exactly what I just said. So now he's like, you just see, if you read this whole letter, it's going back and forth, back and forth. So now, what do I do? So he finally comes up with what is his final chil. Here's where he finally ends. Ach efshar. Dekevan to shigam im ha-Yisrael yimna melahar shem. Right, he's talking in Chutzlaritz. If the Jew doesn't put his name down on the list to receive the heart, mikomako marof levatai yase zos avur acherim. So the in Chutzlaritz, the non-Jewish doctor that we're worried about now getting involved in a ritzicha of the non-Jewish donor, if the Jew doesn't go on the list, someone else will be on the list and he's going to do it anyway. That person is picked, the donor, to get this test. He's going to be getting the test. Ve'af to be Israel, and here's where the chiluk is. In Eretz Yisrael, ana naktina demifnei shacherim yasu ha'iser, lo paka klal halav shalifnei iver. When it comes to, and somebody said this last week, I think it was you, right? Even though in Eretz Yisrael, it's different. What's going to be going on over there? If one Jew takes himself off the list, who's likely to be the next one on the list? Another Jew, right? In Eretz Yisrael, it's likely to be one Jew who's going to avoid a situation, right? And it's just going to lead to another Jew, right? So therefore, you can't just play around that way. Ultimately, you're going to be, whoever's doing it, it's going to be a Jew. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zemazeh. It's going to be ultimately a Jew who's going to be involved in this Aveira one way or the other. Therefore, you can't just say that you're doing it and because someone else would do it anyway. Because that other person who would do it anyway is a Jew just like you. And that is a violation of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zemazeh, minimally. However, in Chutz Laaretz, right? You don't have that problem. Because the odds are that if you don't do it, so some non-Jew is going to be doing it. Right? Rove are going to be non-Jews always in Chutz Laaretz. Mikol makom lagavei nochri nira lachare deshapir muta v'kol shiken b'makom pikuach nefesh shel Yisroel v'shapir muta l'harshem. And he goes on with four other points, right? All coming together to say, and again he throws in karov levadai, that this person's really dead anyway, right, based on the whole testing. And after tzirif of all these and two zrikos, we're going to do it twice. It's a very complicated hetter. At the end of the day, it's much different than the feeling you get after Rav Aaron Soloveitchik tells you, don't worry, you put your name on the list, you're doing nothing. You're not a grower of tzirikah by any means. But Rav Shlomo Zalman doesn't agree with that. That's the tension, that's what he's fighting with over here. Rav Shlomo Zalman feels you are a grower of tzirikah. If this were a Jew and a Jew, that's awesome. But he somehow has to tease out why is it different in Chutz Laaretz. So he compiles all these nekudos nekula, ultimately saying is that I have no responsibility as a Jew whose life is threatened to worry that some non-Bnei Bris is going to be, I'm doing lifnei iver to another Bnei Bris, to another non-Bnei Bris, in this type of situation when they're likely to be dead, and he's like, sorry, if all these different nekudos, then it's okay. So at the end of the day, he finds room for the kula, and Rav Yashiv is Mako, and the Tzitz Eliezer is Mako, and Rav Moshe we know was passing. So halacha l'maisa, somebody who needs a transplant in the United States really has a psak of all the gold that you can take. Just about everybody, right, says he can. The only ones who would argue are people like Rabbi Tendler says, you can't say that. He'll say, if you don't buy my full brain death definition, you have no right to say that you can also take the heart. But the truth is, and he brings Rav Shlomo Zalman as the raya to that point, but as you see from this letter, Rav Shlomo Zalman goes to pains to actually show that it is still mutter to accept the heart. The problem is, in the last paragraph, he writes that he was told, or in the second, right before the last paragraph, he was told by Professor Abraham that the truth is, and this is accurate, in most cases, this test is not done. The imaging study won't do it. That was the problem I started with when I told you the problem I had over the summer was there was that case and they had asked me to find out if a proper brain death was declared. And I knew that they didn't, I surmised that they didn't, and then I confirmed that they didn't do the imaging study. So what do you do? So Shlomo Zalman says, if there's no imaging study, then I got to start all over again. And Rav Avraham tells me that usually they don't do the imaging study. So does that mean Shlomo Zalman says it's usher now, even in the United States, to accept the heart? So, no, he finally then, in the last paragraph, turns that around also. And he says, the truth is, then I spoke to Rav Avraham again, Dakra. And he told me that the truth of the matter is, even if you don't get the imaging study,
right? And here's the way I really had difficulty working with this.
Even if you don't get the imaging study, it's karav levadai that the person really is dead. So, therefore, he's makil at the very end. But he's makil in a way that not completely satisfying. So if you turn to the very last page, Rabbi Breidowitz, who always, in my, well, I better not say this, I love Rabbi Breidowitz. I love the way he always captures the essence of controversies. So over here, he wrote an article, what I thought was a very objective article, over, you know, like looking at this entire issue, this entire topic, and all the different shittos. Nice overview. And in it, he mentions that there are some people that say that if you reject brain death or respiratory death, then you should not be receiving heart transplants either. But he said that he didn't think that was true, and he quotes Rav Soloveitchik, and he quotes Rabbi Bleich, who both maintain that the recipient should not be viewed as a goyim at all, just as we said. That according to their shita, not a problem. They don't go through all the machinations that Rav Shlomo Zalman has to, but Dover Pashut almost, that according to Rav Soloveitchik, according to Rabbi Bleich, and Rabbi Breidowitz agrees with it, he's very comfortable with it, don't compare. Putting your name on a list is not in any way a goyim mitzvah. So Rabbi Tendler writes back after this article was published, and he says, not true. And he names the name of the person who made the original statement not to, that a Jew cannot receive if he doesn't believe in brain death. And then he says, the fact that there are others who are ready and willing to remove their organs in no way mitigates the act of murder. He says, don't think that just because that Nakuda, right, that other people are going to be taking the heart anyway, that you're any less a murderer. And what does he compare it to? He says, if there are 10 hitmen ready to kill this one guy, and one does it, the fact that there were 9 others doesn't take away from his act of ritzicha. So is that a good analogy? So I would not have thought so on my own. And Rabbi Bernhutz jumps on it and says, also, that's not a good analogy at all. No one would say, if you do a kumba se act of ritzicha, that you could ever use as an excuse that there are 20 other people that wanted to kill the guy also. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about on the bottom on the right side is one who places his name on a list to receive a transplant is at worst only a goyim ritzicha, an indirect cause. And while it is true that even a grumba of ritzicha is forbidden, the existence of alternative recipients means that any given recipient cannot even be characterized as a goyim. You're not the goyim in this type of case, because this person is going to die one way or the other, right? He's not going to die because you're on the list. The only time that becomes a difficult argument to make is, in theory, if all the people on the list are Jews, right? That's the chiluk that we ultimately are going to have. That if everybody on the list, all the recipients are Jews, then one might be able to argue you get back into that kol Yisrael arim zeh bazeh situation. That everyone on that list has a problem. Because they're either goyim mitzicha or some other Jews can be goyim mitzicha. So if you're participating in the risk, you're part of this grand goyim mitzicha done by Jews to this individual. That is the way it seems Rav Shlomo Zalman is making the chiluk ultimately between what goes on in the United States, which is mutter, because if you're not the goyim mitzicha, because the other people who would be doing it anyway are not Jewish, that's okay. But in Eretz Yisrael, where everybody has to be accountable for everybody else, Kol Yisrael Rebbe Zavizeh, then it's much more difficult to come out of the issue of goyim mitzicha. Does anyone have any questions on this topic? We're going to end it right here. All right. The topic for today.
I think Rabbi touched on this before about what have been the effects of the fact that non-Jews seem to be, it doesn't look so nice. The idea that, you know, we're basically willing to receive the organs, but obviously we would not be put ourselves on the donation list.
Right, so that's a problem. That's a problem in reality. Doesn't change the halacha at all, right? Because if we're talking about an act of ritzicha, we're not going to suddenly allow that, but we're not going to allow people to take hearts just to avoid the eva even that might exist. Even if it was pikuach nefesh, we wouldn't be allowed to do that. if we considered it an act of betzicha to take that person's heart. So it's a very difficult situation, and it really is one that I, in reality is difficult, that I told you I encountered. I don't know if I told you, but I had this happen to me.
Right.
And that's a realistic problem. I don't think that there's a halakhic remedy for it. In other words, if you hold that taking the heart out is an act of betzicha, there's nothing you can do about it. And yet, you have to save the lives of people that require hearts. Is it a kiddush Hashem to volunteer that we should say, even though halacha really is that you can accept it, the kol nefesh, you can accept the heart, so we should voluntarily say, you know, mishum evo, mishum darki shalom, or al kiddush Hashem? It's an interesting question. That's a thing about it. Is that tenable? You know, it's easy to say in theory, it's impossible to implement when you're in a situation. You're dealing with a family. And there's a loved one who's dying, so just tell them, you know, really, migar din, you should be able to take a heart, you should get a transplant, you don't have to let your relative die, or the relative, I guess an individual, that would be the shiloh, really. An individual could choose for themselves such a course, maybe, right? So you could say, look, I think it's kiddush Hashem if I say, look, I wouldn't donate, so I'm not going to accept. That might be a prerogative of an individual, and maybe he would be accountable for the suicide of it all. But I think that would be the only area for discussion along those lines. For someone else to make the decision for that individual, I think it's a little difficult in practical sense.
If you're talking about something as invasive and complicated as a transplant, is there in general a need to accept it?
Yeah, I think it's nowadays, I'll tell you the truth, it's beyond experimental. It's very well proven in terms of its outcome. So normally when we talk about the these type of situations, you need a refuah beduka to make it into the realm of something you're allowed to do this sakana. Huh? In terms of, do you have a choice to give up refuah because we're about to talk about this topic right now, because of what? Chaim b'Yisurin, that you're going to have suffering through the life of a transplant recipient. So it's open for discussion as we're about to, but in my experience with transplant patients, it's not pleasant, like a normal life totally, but it's not the getting user, I would not think so. Especially, it often involves people who have been so devastated by their original disease and so compromised that when they get the transplant, having to come in every month for a biopsy or something like that means nothing compared to the way they feel in between. So I in answer to your question, I think that it's not one that necessarily, if you hold its mutter to receive, I think that you're almost high. You should do it. You should do all that. Because I don't think it's like, there'll be exceptions to that. There'll be certain situations where the operation itself will be a big risk. That's usually not the case. If that happens, then things were not planned out right. The way transplant should go is that it should be, you know, sort of organized in a sudar way, that the person gets to a certain degree of his illness, he goes on the list, at least that's experience in pediatrics, where we get hearts a little easier than the adults do. It shouldn't be that the operation itself is such a big sakana. There are situations where I've been where he is, and then what you're saying is entirely true. Then that person is not clear to put himself at that risk of losing the chayisha that he has. Right? We talked about that topic. You know, being risky chayisha chayola, right? Are you really chayiv to do it? It'll depend on the percentages, but there are times when the risk of operation is over 50%, where it's certainly not chayiv to do something in that situation, and you can just shev al tasa and not do it. But otherwise, in a normal case, where the operation itself is not a big deal, transplant operation itself is actually, by cardiothoracic standards, not such a big deal. It's the life after that's always the consideration in looking at compliance and the side effects, and the fact that you have to go in for a cardiac biopsy, which is a big deal, it's a whole invasive procedure, but those thin out over time. If you polled all the transplant recipients, I am almost certain the vast majority would choose to do it again in that situation. They wouldn't say, oh, this life is horrible, I wish I hadn't done it. You don't hear that. The only ones you hear that from sometimes teenagers that are in a very vulnerable stage of their life anyway, and any little, you know, disturbance to their appearance, things like that, make a dramatic effect on them, and they are dissatisfied. And maybe it would have been better not to live. But a mature adult generally does not feel that way. So that's an interesting segue into the next topic. We're not going to have that much time to discuss it. And I think this might be our last session together. So what I want to make sure that you get out of this, minimally, because euthanasia in 20 minutes, right, is not an easy thing to do. But in my experience, talking to people who are kind of sorry in this situation, and to, let's say, pre-meds and smicha students and different people, there's a lot of confusion about euthanasia. People mix everything up. They take all types of different situations and assume that they all have the same criteria for analysis of PLO. Truthfully, there's three subcategories to euthanasia that I find are the most useful in organizing and thinking about these situations. And lo aleinu, but unfortunately, many of us will encounter this. Situation number one is the most extreme that is going to be easily put to rest, and that is this article on the top of page one. When torment is baby's destiny, euthanasia is defended. I was cringing as I was reading this article, I have to tell you. Mainly because you'll see one of the points is what prompted these guys to put this thing together, and what we're talking about here is actively selecting individuals based on your perception of their value of their lives and telling and making the active conscious decision to end the life. Right? That's the most extreme form of euthanasia, which is not even going to be up for discussion up the halacha. What made me cringe the most is that they say one of their impetus for doing this was because they know it's ma'isim b'chayom, that around the world, doctors are making these kind of decisions all the time, and they just felt it should be out in the open and no more, you know, under the covers. And I agree that that is an accurate description of the way things are. I, myself, have encountered this thinking in the good old US of A, right? It's not just in the Netherlands. And it's a scary notion, you know, by well-meaning people that think along the following lines, right? The opening paragraph, baby's born, the opening lines already just get right to the point. Into what is certain to be a brief life of grievous suffering should have their lives ended by physicians under strict guidelines. Oh, glad you said under strict guidelines, because I was getting nervous that you were going to say something that was loose. So they tell you on the bottom, if you skip all the way down to the bottom lines, right? These two doctors were trying to bring a measure of accountability to acts that go on every day around the world, which I tell you is true. So they said like this. They knew in the Netherlands, euthanasia to adults, defined as 16 years or older, competent thinkers that can make the conscious decision, I want to die, is mutter, right? In the Netherlands, a person over 16 years of age who requests, and I'd like to know more details exactly how it works there. You know, I have a cold. Okay, I choose to die. I don't want to take the vitamin C. I don't know how far they go. Right? That's obviously an exaggeration, but where they draw the line would be interesting. But in the Netherlands, for an adult, a person who's got DAS, can make this decision. So then what's the natural follow-up to that? What about these poor little babies that are going to be going through the same suffering as these adults but don't have the DAS to make that decision for themselves? So therefore, deliberate life-ending procedures are also acceptable for newborns and infants, despite the fact that these patients cannot express their own will, which we're sure, since we know it all, we're sure this is what they would want. So they divide up all infants into three groups, all infants that are in the realm of having this euthanasia done to them. And we're talking about killing them, not just letting them go, actively killing them. What are the three groups? So the first, this is the second column, bottom paragraph, is made up of infants with no chance of survival because of whatever underlying disease. So rather than let them slowly go to their deaths, we will end it quickly and easily. Group number two. So all right, we'll talk about that group, al pi halacha, soon. Group number two, a very poor prognosis, dependent on ICU. And therefore they have a poor quality of life. All right, we're moving over, sliding, until we get to group number three, which is really the one that is the most striking. The third group has a hopeless prognosis and experience what parents and medical experts deem to be unbearable suffering, whether or not they need intensive care. What's an example of this? Spina bifida. What's spina bifida? Anyone know anyone with spina bifida? Ever hear of it? Spina bifida is a disease, a congenital disease, where the individual is born without fusion, closure of their spinal column. What does it result in? Paralysis of varying degrees, depending on what level this happens. Incontinence. By no means is it a pleasant life for this person. What about in terms of intelligence? Normal. Emotions? Normal. Functioning otherwise? Normal. But this group would be in there. So along comes, if you look at the last paragraph, Douglas J. Sarica, a lawyer in Oklahoma City who has spina bifida. He said that the doctors might be quick to classify a baby as hopeless case who might, with the right medical care, lead a happy and productive life, like him. And then he ends it off, I thought, in the most striking and very, very significant way. I would say that I have a life worth living. My wife would say that. My family would say that. You see, the absolute obvious pitfall to their whole thinking is, who are they to judge the value of an individual's life to the point of ending it for them? And if you go back to the first column, who is it that's going to make these decisions? So they're trying to be objective and nice about it. The conditions will include the full and informed consent of the patients, the parents, the agreement of a team of physicians, and a subsequent review of each case by an outside legal body. So who is going to be deciding the value of everybody's life? Of all these infants, the ones with spina bifida, the ones with whatever condition we realm the line, wherever we deem is the line of life and death? Well, the parents, physicians, and lawyers. That's unbelievable. So physicians and lawyers are going to decide who gets to live or die. To me, it's one of the scariest thoughts. So Baruch Hashem, no one in the secular world in the United States or outside of the Netherlands, as far as I know, there probably are exceptions in other countries, is entertaining this extreme form of euthanasia. We will not need to discuss it. There's obviously no room in Al-Pidin to even get into this. There's no Havamina that such a thing would ever take place. What is there what to talk about? Topic B. The tortured patient. This is a person who's in pain. And I love this quote. This is from a secular bioethicist. When a tortured man asks, "For God's sake, doctor, let me die. Just put me to sleep." We've yet to find the answer as to whether to comply is for God's sake, the patient's sake, our own, or possibly all three. This captures in that little line, to a large degree, the dilemma that people go through that are involved in this situation, right? There's obviously a conflict of values taking place here. If you remember from the very first shiur that we had together, right? When we were talking about the way different bioethical systems work, often it comes down to, no matter what standard you're going to use, whether you're going to go up Torah as we absolutely do, or you're going to go by any other standard that you have, what it always comes down to is the hierarchy in the conflict of values. And right here, we have one of the most acute examples of that. Because on the one hand, what do we have? We have the Gemara in Kedushin, right? At the end of Kedushin, Tov Shvirov from the Gehenna. Anyone get up to that sugya? Right? Right at the very end. What does the Tosfos Tzvi HaZaken say? Why is it Tov Shvirov from the Gehenna? Because they are killing Cholim. They're letting the Cholim die. What's he talking about? Pshat is euthanasia. A Rofe sometimes thinks he's doing a good thing by letting a Cholim die. That we have on the one hand. On the other hand, in Sanhedrin it says, V'haftar recha kamocha, right? What does that mean? Yivra lo, misa yofe. That we want to make sure that death is as pleasant as possible. And we really begin to see, if you turn the page, we're going to quickly overview this. On the left, in the Nishmas of Ram, he quotes the Minchas Chinuch, the Gesher HaChayim, and Rav Jacobowitz. All who talk about value number one. Value number one in our conflict is the value, the intrinsic absolute value of life, right? It doesn't matter if you're a katan or a zakein, right? A katan with 70 years or a zakein with 1 year left, your life is equally valuable. Why? Because as the Gesher HaChayim and Rav Jacobowitz point out, life is of infinite value. There's no division or multiplication of infinity, right? There's no way of giving any erech to a life in the sense that one is worth ending and one is not. And we saw in another context when we were talking about Shabbos and Pikuach Nefesh, the Chofetz Chaim attitude. Why is it that you can be Machal Shabbos for even Chayisha? So the Meiri had said, because maybe you can be Chozer B'tshuva, you can do some type of mitzvah. But the Chofetz Chaim says there's nothing to do with mitzvahs. You can be Machal Shabbos because there's absolute intrinsic value to life. And he even goes through the details, whether it's a katan, a cherish, a shote, a goses, a chayisha, it doesn't matter. All of that is human life, which has intrinsic absolute value. And on the bottom, the biggest, the one who screams the loudest, this slogan is Rabbi Bleich. Rabbi Bleich always is very, very adamant in insisting on this absolute value, and all of mankind recognizes it. It's almost natural morality that there's an absolute value to life, and you'll do everything you can to preserve it. But if I asked you, is that true? Al pi din, is there absolute, paramount, absolute, total, top value to life? Al pi din, is that true? No. Three rayas right off the bat. Can everyone give me? Just give me one raya.
The Canaanites and Amalekites, they deserve to die, according to Jewish law.
Okay, but I'm talking about innocent life, even.
Who?
Innocent life. You're talking about someone's Chayv Misa, right? So that's true. In other words, that itself shows that there's something higher than life itself. That is another rabbi. But let's say even less dramatic. How about Yahav Vayavu? Whole concept of Yahav Vayavu. What does that mean? That means you die and you don't do the Avera. Why? Because as great and absolute a value life is, there's something more valuable not to do those Averas. And what about Mechenes Mitzvah? You're going to go out and we know people are going to die. But that's secondary to the objective of the Mechavis Mitzvah. And what about Dayla Kiddush Hashem in general? Also, Kiddush Hashem is more important than human life. So it is an absolute. And what other possible thing could take precedence over life? So if you turn the page, there's one other possible thing, and it's a fascinating sugya, and that is pain. Pain itself. Pain and suffering, right, might supersede life itself. What's this sugya? You should really be naive this more than I'm going to do right now. I'll quickly run through it. It's a well-known sugya in Ksuvos, where as part of the sugya there, they make the statement that hasra for davar chamor, hasra for, let's say, misa, will automatically count for malchus, right? Hasra for davar chamor is going to count for davar kaf. So the Gemara is going to make that claim. So it's going to be a machlokas, do we really even say that? But let's say, assume we do say that. Hasra for the davar chamor counts for the davar kaf. But the Gemara says, who says that misa is more chamor than malchus? Why not? Because, as the Gemara states, could be the other way around. Could be that pain's worse than death. How do I know that? So Ilmale Nagdua Lachanani Mishav Azariah Palchul Tzalma, that what were they given the choice? Death or bow down to the idols? So we'll take death, I'm going over. But what if the Gemara says, what if they had been offered the following? Either bow down to those idols, or we're gonna torture you on a daily basis for the rest of your lives. So it could be that they should or would have bowed down to the idols. So that becomes a machlokes rishonim. The implication, if you look at Tosfos over here, it clearly is that the Gemara seems to be saying that perhaps it's not Yahav Vayavur. Yisurin is not Yahav Vayavur. That's what the Gemara seems to be implying. So Tosfos says, but that's a kasha, because what about Rabbi Akiva? We all know the story of Rabbi Akiva. What did he do? Right? B'chol Nafshecha, that was his kiyum of B'chol Nafshecha, finally, was to be tortured to death. So don't we see that was still...
You didn't have a choice, though.
What's the difference between that? What's the difference between what he's doing, possibly, and what's going on over here?
They didn't tell him about Akiva, you worship an idol. They just killed him because they wanted to say a message.
No, he's very happily going to death, right? He is being Makayan, the whole nafshim. He's doing a kiyum of something of a mitzvah in the Torah by dying in this torturous way. The implication is that would be. Even torture is just as bad. So, Tosfos wants to get away from drawing the conclusion that the Gemara is really telling me that suffering is worse, and that I wouldn't have to suffer, I could do the Aveira. So Tosfos, Rabbeinu Tam, gives this, you know, interesting answer. He says, the truth is that they weren't really being told to bow to Avodah Zarah. It wasn't really Avodah Zarah. There was no Elahut in the idols. And he comes up with this whole approach. But if you look at the Shita Mekubetzes, he really spells it out. Shita Mekubetzes quotes from the Kutcherson, Pirush Arav Eliezer, Delo Chai V'Torah Ela Limtzur Atzman L'Misa. What does the Torah expect of us? That in the face of Avodah Zarah, we should be moser ourselves to Misa. Kedirsi B'chol Nafshecha, Afilu Hu No Teles Nafshecha. Aval HaHachmer Aleihem Yosem M'Misa, Lo Hayu Chayavim. B'Yafa Pirish, U'mashi Hiksha Alav Rabbi Natan, the Rabbi Akiva, the Chaverav, right, where he was like raped with the iron comb, and he still wouldn't bow down. Nearly the low kashamidi, the hasan hakash yishba kitzvah. The kevan shesarka was bizarre. What did Rabbi Akiva know? That he was going to die very quickly. So this was not going to be an endless torture. But in the face, this shita in the Shita Mekubetzes is going to conclude, in the face of endless nightmare torture, right? That's worse than death. And it's quite possible that the message is Yavro Va'al, and don't suffer. At the end, the Shita says, really, we should go with Tosfos. He rejects this view. But what's the point? The point is, it's enough, it's significant enough that Rav Moshe, in Yigos Moshe, quotes this, right? Rav Moshe has a Shita that we would have gotten to, where Rav Moshe is allowing, if a person is in a situation, Rav Moshe's son, where they have no refuah, and they're just suffering, and there's certainly, the doctor comes and says, you know what, we could do dialysis, we could do all these different things to prolong the life. So, but doctor, are you going to make it any better? Is there going to be recovery here? I'm really sorry, but we could prolong the life. But what life? He's suffering endlessly. So Moshe would say, Shabbat Tasseh. Shabbat Tasseh. And there's a riot, and he brings this, because at times, the Gemara points out that there are things worse than we say. If you look on the bottom of the Makor over there, then there's another approach. If you think of Sota, Sota is interesting because Sota implies just the opposite, right? What's happening with the Sota? The Sota was guilty, right? She drinks. What's going to happen? Right away, the changes begin. The gross, horrible changes. But, and then she'll die pretty quickly. Unless what?
She was innocent?
No, she's guilty. No. But what? She can have certain Zechlios that will keep her going. Right? If she facilitated Talmud Torah of her children, if she learned Torah, right? This is the whole beginning of that famous Kol Melamed is Bita Torah, right? What's the Skliot going to get her? It's going to get her a long, drawn-out life in the same condition that she's already started to be in. So
she
that
dies.
Already...
The longer she lives, she just dies slower.
She dies more slowly, basically. So that this Gemara implies the opposite of what this Gemara does. This Gemara really implies a life with a certain amount of suffering is still better than no life at all. So how do you reconcile the theory of teams? So there's possibilities. If you were just talking about Malabatish, you could say, well, maybe the degree of suffering, that's the issue, right? But it becomes more than Malabatish, because that actually will become Lamaisa relevant, because it's going to often be up to whom? The person who's going to be receiving the pain. Right? If the person says, look, I'd rather live, then they have a right to choose that. Because you see, it's a suffix, really, which way this goes. Which is worse, pain or death? Well, it's very subjective. Depends on the person's attitude and their tolerance for pain. So you can't make any absolute rule in this realm. And often you'll see the post-skim are going to be very concerned with what does the patient themselves feel about the situation. When does that get impossible or difficult or impossible? When they're not conscious, right? Then it becomes something where Rav Moshe is willing to say the stam individual would prefer death to the pain. That's like the conclusion of his true, right? He says, that's like a chidish agav chidish. He says, v'af b'stama k'shelo shayach leida das hachola yesh liklos she'en hachola rotse leika hachiyev b'refosa. That's a very big chiddush that he throws in over there. But it also points to, since we have limited time, I'm going to just point out to you that the third topic, I want you to realize there's a chiluk between these types of euthanasia. The first was that extreme, crazy, kill babies that we don't like what their life's going to be like, right? Forget that.
the real important topics of euthanasia to know about is the patient who's in pain and suffering, how much intervention do you do, where are you allowed to stop intervention, and then the final topic, which is not the same as this topic, is the Terry Schiavo case, and cases like that. The Ariel Sharon case right now. Meaning somebody, right, and here's a whole description for all of you on persistent vegetative state. Remember we talked about brain death versus just knocking out the top part of the brain, the cortex? So there are people that, if one of them get into that situation, they're certainly alive, l'chulei alma, but they have absolutely no awareness of functioning. What do you do with them? Do you do what they did with Terry Schiavo? You take away hydration, you take away nutrition, you let them die that way? That becomes a shadow. What does the Torah have to say about it? And there's a lot to be said about it. The post can talk about it and give psak on this. And there's differing opinions. If you go through this handout, you could see this is sort of just sort of the background. Halach l'maisa is all going to be in this handout, which unfortunately I'm not going to get to do with you, but I'm happy to discuss it with anyone who wants to talk to me about it. This last handout is all the halach l'maisa on these situations. And what I try to do is track through the Gemara, the Sharon, and the Psach, the Shulchan Aruch and Psach on how to handle these situations. The reason this is important to everybody, part of just general knowledge of these areas, is I'm going to share with you this quickly. One last thing, which anyone is welcome to copy if he wants it. And that is, nowadays, there's a lot of promotion of these. These are living wills, Alpi Halacha, right? RCA, Aguda. What I wanted to discuss with you, maybe it's Hashem, one day in the future we'll get to do it, is there's differences that are very interesting between the way the RCA approaches this and the way the Aguda does. And it would be very interesting, Alpi, the Psach, the Maisa, that's how you would understand. For example, I'll just show you some of the examples. If you look at the RCA is amazing. The RCA gives you all those conditions we just talked about, right? What if you are a persistent vegetative state? So under that, has a series of questions about what you would want them to do, right? Your choice. I want this, I don't want this. I want this, I don't want this. On a whole series of interventions. And then, no choice. Antibiotics and simple diagnostic tests must be administered. That you don't have a choice on. Why? Why have a choice on the other things but antibiotics and diagnostic tests? No. Bigger question, what they don't even mention, I was surprised, what about nutrition and hydration? That's not in here. That's dangerous. Like I'm going to like talk to Rabbi Teller, I'm going to say, why are you leaving out hydration and nutrition? Unless, I'm assuming they took it for granted, right? Of course everyone's going to do that. But it's not true in the secular world at all, as we saw. By no means. The math might need to be amended to this. Right? And you must give hydration and nutrition, because according to this, I'm not a lawyer, Baruch Hashem, I mean, I shouldn't say that. But I would think that according to this, a doctor has a right to withhold nutrition and hydration, and no one can say that the patient denied it. This doesn't make any mention. Then it goes through a sort of all the situations of now you're in a coma with a small possibility of recovery. And it gives different choices. And it starts adding different must-do. Right? Since there's a small chance of recovery, it mentions now you have to do a few other things. Before it was just antibiotics, now you got to give blood products. It ups the ante a little. It's very interesting the way this works. They must have been sitting over this, I can just imagine, with doctors and Rabbanim. They must have worked very hard on it. But it has with all that work and all that detail, it actually, in my view, makes it more difficult. More difficult from my personal halakhic perspective.
Do we hold a lot of emotion?
Huh?
You said before? Or if someone's...
We hold? We'll talk about that after. I'll talk about... we'll talk about who you hold like in general. They also throw in organ donation here, right? And of course, with accepting brain death. They in a more recent one on organ donation, the RCA would give you the choice. You don't have to accept. The Aguda is a completely different approach. No details like that. The emphasis of the Aguda, and we'll get back to this in a second, is to have a competent rabbinic authority be the one able to oversee these decisions. That's their major focus. They give
a healthcare representative, you give the full name and address, and then an alternate. And then that's point number one. We want a competent healthcare representative. That's your most important thing that you got to do. And then number two, right, and they'll figure out all these details at that time because this situation changes. That's what makes this very difficult to predict ahead of time how you'll feel and what the situation and all the details are. Then, also, Jewish law must govern the care decisions, and therefore, it's going to need to have competent rabbinic authority, and that seems to be the emphasis here without providing any of the kind of details. But anyone who wants to look at these, you're more than welcome to take a look at them in more detail or copy them. You can see them. It's kedai for everyone to discuss this with people they're comfortable with, because the truth of the matter is it will facilitate that things are done the way you want them to be, al pi din, to have it. It's better to have it than to not have it. When it's not there, the doctors have much more free run on what goes on, or family members, and depending on who they are, that could be what you would want or not want. You know, everyone has a different situation with that. So we'll stop a little short of what we really want to accomplish today. But again, please feel free to talk to me about any open questions.
Thank you very much for the course. I appreciate your presence. Sorry, I have 30 and a half.